Tango Tango Papa 1910, May 18, 2015.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Marietta, Georgia. So I dropped and hooked this evening in Atlanta, and I was led to believe originally that that was supposed to be it was supposed to be a live unload, and I had my suspicions, but in any case, I got there at 7 p.m. when it was supposed to supposedly live unload, and it turned out to be a drop and hook. So the A service is due on the truck, and that has to be done. I can put it off a little bit, but I've already put it off, and so it has to be done. So I came to the Marietta terminal. And it will probably be, he said it would probably be maybe late tomorrow afternoon when they actually take it inside the shop and work on it. But it has to be done, A service. And then the only thing that's actually, that I know is actually kind of wrong with it is if you, the steering is telescoping, and it so it's much like you'd find in a lot of in cars, especially with the telescoping steering wheel. You can kind of push it up out of the way, so it tilts up and down, and it pulls in and out. And what has been happening, I don't know, it's been doing this for about a month or month and a half now, maybe not quite that long, but what it's been doing is if you push it all the way in, it has a tendency to make the left turn signal come on. And I'm thinking that there's because there's a switch on the side of the steering column, I'm thinking that probably the wiring harness, one of the wires has gotten chafed over time, and that's causing the thing to short out, however it does it, and make that left turn signal come on. So the cure of to make it not come on is to pull the steering wheel out a little bit, telescope it out a little bit, and that usually stops it. But it can be a little bit annoying sometimes, because I've had it do that while I was actually driving down the road. That's what happened the very first time I was driving down the road, and all of a sudden my left turn signal came on for no reason, and I didn't turn it on. So they can fix that, and so with the A service, they kind of go around the truck and look at everything and grease things and check things out and look the tires over very closely. And they look the truck over pretty closely, and they fix anything that needs fixing. So maintenance wise. So they'll be doing that tomorrow, and as I say, that has to be done. So I just need to bite the bullet and do it. So I drove through some very heavy rain when I was on my way to the place there in Atlanta this evening. It was late this afternoon or early this evening, however you want to look at it. Very heavy rain. Now, it's calm this evening. There's no rain now. I think it's still fairly humid. Temperature-wise, I'm guessing it's probably in the mid-70s. So it's actually not bad. Some people would be probably bugged by the high humidity. But and at one time, I was. You go back years ago, and I would really notice high humidity when I'd go to a really high humidity area, like anywhere in Georgia, South Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana, Florida, Eastern Texas, any of those places that would have high humidity, I would really notice it and dislike it. But something's happened over the years, and I guess I've just gotten used to it. I can tell the difference between high humidity and lower humidity, but it really doesn't affect me very much. Now, if you're really exerting yourself with high humidity, even in the mid-70s, I would work up quite a sweat, but just not exerting myself mid-70s with high humidity, not really a problem. I don't know. So I think you do kind of acclimate to higher humidity. At least I have. So what I have, I've got a couple of pieces of audio. One from Joel and another one from Mark. But before I do that, I have if I can find it here, I have an article about self-driving vehicles. And let me see if I can, should have that here on my phone. Let's see, that's not what I was looking for. See if there's the rest of it. I may have to go find the article. Thought I had it saved. Well, I'm going to have to stop this and find the article. Be right back. Okay, I found it. Learned something about the browser on my phone. I'm using I guess you'd call it a stock browser that Samsung gives you. It's just called Internet. On most Samsung devices, and it's got a feature that allows you to save web pages for offline reading. I've never really pushed the issue, but I have ran into this problem before where I can't find where it's stored the offline pages, and I just figured it out. So what you have to do is, put the phone in landscape view. So hold it in landscape view so it shifts the page around. And then down at the bottom, you've got some symbols. And you just tap on the right one, and it shows you all of your saved pages. So learn something new. So it does save pages. So that'll actually be handy. That'll come in handy. So in any case, I found this. This was from Slate.com, and it's an article about Google's self-driving car. So the title of the article, Google's fully driverless cars are ready for the road. Well, comma, some roads. Then they got a picture of Google's little self-driving bubble car. Let's see. Google has been testing self-driving car technology on American roads for 6 years now, and with mostly encouraging results. Until now, however, it has used specially outfitted versions of mass production cars like the Toyota Prius and Lexus RX 450H. On Friday, the company announced that it's ready to put its own custom-built fully self-driving cars on public streets for the first time. Yes, those cute little Kola mobiles are apparently road-ready just a year after Google introduced them to the world. They'll start out by tooling around the intimately familiar Mountain View, California roadways that Google's self-driving Lexuses have been cruising and painstakingly mapping for the past couple of years. Google's prototypes are designed to be not just self-driving, but fully driverless. They have no steering wheels, brakes, or gas pedals, just buttons you push to start the ride. As you can see in the video below, they're designed to be capable of completing their journey without anyone in the driver's seat at all. Unfortunately for Google, California's self-driving car law doesn't allow that. It requires all autonomous vehicles to be street legal and to have a human behind the wheel. So for the time being, Google says it will outfit its robotic tortoise on wheels with removable steering wheels, accelerators, and brake pedals so that the person in the driver's seat can take over at a moment's notice. It will also cap their speed at 25 miles per hour, making it unlikely that anyone will die even on the off chance that they accidentally mow someone down. For the record, while Google's self-driving cars have been involved in a handful of minor accidents over the years, Google says not once has its autonomous driving system been at fault. What's interesting about this is that Google doesn't really believe that putting a human being behind the wheel makes its self-driving car safer. It's happy to comply with California's law for now, of course, while it's still developing the technology and mapping the terrain. But in the long run, the Googlers behind the self-driving car project are convinced that driving will be safer once humans are removed from the equation altogether. That's a view not widely shared, or at least not widely voiced among mainstream automakers, which is part of why Google had to build its own steering wheel-free prototypes in the first place. But at least a few manufacturers may be starting to come around. At the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas in January, for instance, Mercedes rolled out a futuristic concept car in which four passengers face each other rather than the road ahead. Whether we'll see anything like that on public streets in our lifetimes will depend in part on the success of the prototype, or the types of tests that Google is doing today, and it certainly won't happen anytime soon. One other thing that isn't likely to happen anytime soon, sighting a Google self-driving car prototype on a random street in any town, USA. As The Atlantic's Alexis Madrigal explained last year, near-perfect information about a given roadway has been crucial to self-driving car success so far. Google has turned parts of Mountain View into a virtual test track by mapping literally every speed bump and stop sign. Google said in a statement Friday that it is starting to send some of its self-driving Lexuses into new territory, including San Francisco, where they'll encounter fresh challenges like hills and fog. Until further notice, however, the driverless prototypes will stick to the cozy confines of Google's hometown. So, there you go. It's as I've said before, that with this, any kind of automation, you have to eliminate as many variables as possible. And once you're able to eliminate all of the really important variables so that everything is known, the really important stuff is known, then there's a little bit of leeway for the automation to kick in, but it has to follow certain rules. Everything has to be a controlled environment, and then the thing can kind of follow rules. It's sort of like a roller coaster. A roller coaster, as long as everything, the mechanics are all the mechanical parts of it are all in shape, then the roller coaster, it may seem thrilling, and it may be able, capable of putting a rider, a passenger, through heavy G-forces of various kinds, but it's pretty much known. It's a known system, and as long as everything is mechanically is in good shape, the thing is safe. Now, if a variable goes wrong, let's say a wheel falls off, or which has been known to happen, something goes wrong, a part falls off, something you end up with some kind of metal fatigue, and then all of a sudden you have a disaster. So if you can, with automation, what you have to do is eliminate all of the important variables, and then you have a closed system, and then the automation, as long as the mechanics of it can work right, the automation is able to kick in. I watched a couple of evenings ago, I watched a really interesting video about, it was, I think it was originally on National Geographic Channel. It was about Elon Musk, and this was from 2 or 3 years ago, and Tesla Motors, and they were about to come out with the Model S whenever this video was put together. And they were showing inside the Tesla factory in Fremont, California. They were showing the they were still setting the thing up. They'd been working on this factory for I think a couple of years, getting the thing ready to be able to roll out that Model S. They'd already rolled out the the first one they had is a Tesla Roadster, which that was super expensive. They had, I don't remember what the production run, they had relatively few of those, and then the Model S they had more of. And but in any case, they had a they were showing the robotics. The Tesla car factory in Fremont is heavily automated, and so they were showing this welding robot in particular. And the welding robot had to be taught by an actual they had someone that was had lots of experience welding, and so they had him in there, and then he had to teach that thing, the computer, and kind of map the where the robot would be able to weld millimeter by millimeter by millimeter, so that it would be able to follow that space exactly. And then once the exact coordinates for the robot were known, so it could weld, then it could be turned loose. The program could be turned loose. Well, it turned out there was a problem, and it was maybe a millimeter off, and so they had to work on that a little bit more, and they finally they got it working. They got it so that it was exact. But any kind of robotics, any kind of automation, it has to know what the variables are. There is no room for it to, for a robot cannot make a decision. It can follow its any kind of programming. It can follow instructions, but it cannot make a decision. It can follow instruction sets. There is no such thing as artificial intelligence. As much as some people would like to believe that there can be. And I really believe that the people that want to believe that artificial intelligence is something that human beings can achieve, I think really what drives that is the same thing that drives human beings to sin. It's the same thing that we want to be our own God. We want to be as our own God, and so if we can separate ourselves, pretend like our Creator doesn't exist, that somehow all of this just happened and we find ourselves here and there is no Creator, it's just all random happenings, somehow we're here, and so we're going to be able to, since we're just machines that sort of somehow happened, we just kind of somehow happened along, dust became aware of itself, we should be able to replicate that and create our own artificial intelligence that's going to be even smarter than we are. But what really drives that is that the people that have to believe, they're driven to believe in artificial intelligence, they're driven to believe, and they'll go on and on and on about how they believe in science and the scientific method. What drives that is that those folks are guilty. They are guilty people, and they have things that they want to do, that they want to be able to do, that are detrimental to society, that are detrimental to overall morality, and that are really go against our better nature or our better interest as human beings. They have their little thing that they want to do, and by clinging to the science, you know, pointing to the scientific method and kind of trying to cling to the idea that we're going to create all this, these robots and artificial intelligence, that somehow that mitigates, that they're going to be able to just mitigate the any kind of morality out of existence. And of course it can't be. It just creates chaos. You take morals away, you take any kind of moral rules away, you break down the so-called nuclear family, and you have a recipe for chaos. You want to know why? You look in the news and you see all these horrible things happening. And I can tell you why. The reason that it's happening is because we have systematically, with the public school system, has been systematically screwing the kids' minds up. You want to know why we're having all these riots, and you want to, well, these people won't follow the rules and are spoiled and blah, 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 blah. They were raised that way in the school system. Their parents, the family's broken, and the school system is takes over where the broken family leaves off. And it's, you wonder why there's Waco, Texas. It just happened, I guess, over the weekend. The motorcycle gangs in the that restaurant. You know, wonder why would that happen? Why would these people do that? Why would they? They don't care. They don't care that they're putting people at risk. They don't care that they really don't care. It's all about them. It's all about what they want to do. And if they want to kill each other, then if you're an innocent bystander, too bad. Too bad for you. You shouldn't have been there. This is a result of the broken public school system, the broken morals in families. You destroy the family, this is what you end up with. You end up with utter chaos. And you'll never be able to program people, because what these people think, they think that they can, they're sympathetic towards the idea that we just got to get rid of these morals and we're going to reprogram this, and we're going to come up with some kind of quote-unquote scientific method for reorganizing society, and we're just going to, all we have to do is just get it right, and we're going to be able to program utopia, and people are going to be able to, here comes some dirty words, they're going to just be able to fuck all they want to, sorry about the French, just fuck up a storm, and it doesn't matter, you can marry a dolphin, or screw whatever, and everything's going to be good, and there'll be no guilt, and everything's going to be just wonderful. We'll have utopia. And of course it's not. What you'll have is war. You'll have human beings at war with each other. Because once you break down the family, you cause increased suggestibility, because you have to have, if you're going to reprogram, you've got to make people suggestible. But then the problem is, it's kind of like you take an immune system away, because the family, the nuclear family, functions kind of as an immune system. Take that away, you break that, take that away, take the morals away, then it's like taking your immune system away. It's like you get AIDS and it destroys your immune system. What happens when you destroy your immune system? Any little virus or bacteria can come along and just take over. Why do you think these people, these biker gangs, their lives are so damned empty and so worthless that they why would they join a gang? Why would anybody join a gang? Because they're getting a sense of family, even if it's perverted and 180 degrees backwards, they're getting a sense of family out of it. That's what drives it. On earth as it is in hell. So anyway, self-driving car, it's a scam. At best, we're going to have a super cruise control, and even that, like the cruise controls that we've had for years, you can use it part of the time. It's very useful, but you as a human being have to remain in control of it and know when to engage it and know when not to. Same way with that's going to be with the super cruise control. You're going to have to engage it, know when to do it, and know when to turn it off. But as far as the it's autonomous self-driving car that's not part of that's kind of locked into Mountain View, California, but it's going to be able to just roam across the country, ain't going to happen. There are people, by the way, there are people that are ostensibly intelligent that somehow, I don't know how it happened, but they really believe that the Google cars, the Google mapping cars, are self-driving. I've actually run into somebody that is ostensibly intelligent and should know better, that actually thought that the Google mapping vehicles were self-driving cars. They were self-driving cars. That's ridiculous. Oh, yeah. I don't know where that idea came from, but wishful thinking, I believe. The self-driving car, the autonomous, 100% autonomous self-driving car, scam. Giant scam. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and let's see. So I've got an audio comment from Joel, and then I got one from Mark. So I'm going to play the one from Joel first. It's the shorter of the two. So here is Joel.
Hey, Tom. Joel McLaughlin here. I'm listening to your last podcast. A couple things. One, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's your truck. Maybe it's your inverter. But the last show had like a little electronic buzz on it, on the signal. You may want to just give your last show just a quick listen and see if you hear it as well. Don't know if there's anything you can do about it, but that's just one. Two, the Powerwall. 3,500 for the battery only. Now that's just the battery. It doesn't count installation, and it also doesn't count the inverter that would basically convert the battery, the DC battery power to AC. So it's a lot more than $3,500. You're probably talking, depending on what kind of inverter you get, it's probably be, and any other things for your solar, it would probably be $10,000 or so. So at least that's my thinking. Now, what somebody brought up, and this is actually might be an interesting thing here, and it's something you don't have to deal with because you already have the approval, but some people can't install solar cells now because their power company doesn't want to, you know, either the power company wants to charge an exorbitant rate to get the rights to attach that solar array to their power grid, or they just won't let people do it. One of the two. With this Powerwall setup, apparently, basically, it would just be an inverter, and a converter that would convert the DC to AC on one side, and then the solar cells attached directly to the batteries somehow to charge them. So the solar cells themselves don't necessarily have to be attached to the power grid. In fact, you would not. It would basically take the situation where you do not actually get to charge, basically get paid by the power company to sell their power, sell the extra solar cell power back to them. So that's another interesting thing. Still though, it's not really that revolutionary. It's more or less evolutionary. And could it change things? It could, but I think it's a long way off.
Okay, well, thank you, Joel. Now, I think I know what the buzz was. Because I noticed it from time to time. I'll notice it, and I think I might have a loose connection with the microphone. It's possible. It's kind of hard for me to. I can't tell if it's doing it right now or not, because I've got this battery operated air conditioner back here in my bunk. The fan is running, so there may be a bit of a buzz going right now. But if there is, I think I've got a little bit of a grounding, probably a little grounding issue. Now sometimes you'll hear it's more of an irregular sound, and that is, I know what that is from, and it varies. It where I'm at right now, you're not getting it. I've heard it a couple of times. This evening while I've been recording the podcast, I've heard it a couple of little times, little noises, kind of clicking, popping noises, or staticky noises. And what that is the Verizon Wi-Fi hotspot. But it's not the Wi-Fi. It's the hotspot itself connecting to the Verizon system. And in some cases, and I don't know what the difference is. Somebody that knows more about it could probably explain it exactly. But in some cases, depending on the cell tower that I'm attached to, the thing can be incredibly noisy. And so if it's really noisy, there's been cases where while I'm recording, I just go ahead and shut the Verizon Wi-Fi hotspot off, and that eliminates all the noise. Now right now, the Verizon Wi-Fi hotspot and the little M-Audio fast track that I use, USB sound card that I use to record the podcast with, they're in the same relative positions as they always are, and right now I'm not getting much interference. Like I say, I've heard it a couple times, but right at the moment I don't hear it, at least above the background noise. So now, as far as the Tesla thing, I did go ahead and watch the video. I found the video on YouTube where he was introducing the Tesla Powerwall. And for one thing, I will make a comment. He doesn't seem to have very good speaking skills. I know the guy is obviously very, he's a very talented, intelligent entrepreneur. And he's obviously more than capable of doing things that normal people would consider impossible, and he's somehow able to make them happen. But one thing, he cannot speak very well. If you've noticed, when he's speaking in a public situation like that, he stammers and stutters and he gets it out. He has to do it, obviously, and his poor speaking skills don't seem to hamper him at all. He's able to look at what the man has achieved. It's amazing. So, but he doesn't have the greatest speaking skills in the world. But again, that doesn't seem to have stopped him. So more power to him. Now, as far as that, the Powerwall itself, I need to do more research on it, and maybe there should be some. I should be able to find some articles that go into really great depth as to how the thing works and what comes with it, and what they're envisioning as far as installing. These are all details that they left out of the. They obviously left out of the presentation, but it should be interesting. But as far as batteries go, the lithium ions that they're using should be considerably. That should be a considerably better, more reliable, longer lasting technology than. The traditional lead acid batteries that we're all familiar with. Lead acid batteries work pretty good in cars. That's where they seem to work the best, and that's where they're the most ubiquitous. But that's where. And typically they'll last, the car battery will go maybe about 5-6 years, and then depending on, I guess, the operating environment it's been in, and then they die. So, the lithium ions seem to have better, longer-lasting characteristics than the lead acids do. So, it should be... interesting to see what he's able to make happen, and if they're really able to get the cost of that battery down and make it simple, or as simple as possible to. I think the biggest thing is to get the cost down. That's the biggest problem of all, is getting that cost down, and. Then, kind of depending, you probably have to have professional installers or whatever. But if you can get the cost down, it makes it much more likely that he's going to be able to drive mass market sales. Because obviously, the lower the cost, the greater the potential for mass market sales. So it's should be an interesting thing to watch. So anyway, so let's go ahead. So thank you, Joel. Now I'm going to go ahead and play Mark's comment. So here's Mark.
Hey, Tom, this is Mark. I was listening to your podcast about Elon Musk and the wall charger thing, and wanted to ask your take on electric vehicles, Elon Musk, Tesla, and this whole environmental push for quote-unquote zero-emission vehicles. The one thing I like about electric cars is their origin. Actually, the electric car came out around the same time as the gasoline engine did back in the 1800s. The only problem is that the electronic technology and the battery technology was so crappy back then. It really wasn't efficient, it wasn't practical, so they sort of left it on the shelf and carried on with gasoline-powered cars and kind of left it. And so here we've been in the petroleum industry for all these decades, and it's taken on its development and growth, and we're at today, but with electric cars, they seem to be making a major, I don't want to say a comeback, maybe just a rebirth, if you will. Given the technology that we have today, it's more practical. But I still don't understand this whole zero emission thing. And I see it every time I go to major cities. When I go to San Francisco, you see these electric streetcars everywhere, and they have zero emissions on the top. I guess because they're being run on the electric current. On the wires above the cars. And they really promote their electric cars around the city. And you go to Palo Alto and see all these charging stations, and it's not just Tesla out there. There's other electric cars too. And so I do not understand the zero emissions part. Here's what I mean by that. When you charge your car today, that charge mostly in most cities comes from the grid, and most energy plants these days around the United States are not nuclear. They're not hydroelectric. They're coal-fired or they're fossil fuel-fired plants. Mostly, that's not every case, but let's just talk about the fossil fuel plants. So start at the beginning. You know, how does the car get its energy? Specifically with electric cars. If you go back all the way to the source, let's just start with coal in the mountain. The coal gets extracted from the mountain using machinery, which it takes energy to run that machinery. And it's all solid based, so you're not pumping out of the ground, so it's very hard to get to the coal, and it's very hard to extract the coal. Then they have to be loaded into bins, most likely rail, from the mines, and they get railed over to holding area near the power plant, and there's moving machinery that moves piles of coal from cars to other piles to other piles, and it gets staged until it goes in an area that is burned. So all this movement between piles and between cars and even the trains getting to the plant is all energy consumption that is basically loss from the source of getting the coal. Then you put it into the fire burners to burn the water for the generators to run. There's energy loss in the burning of the coal. So you have a lot of heat that is given off. You have waste from what doesn't burn from the coal that has to be carried away, dealt with. There's energy loss there. Then there's energy loss from the heat that doesn't escape, that enters into the water that becomes steam. There's a certain loss there. The steam goes through a process to run turbine fans. There's a certain energy loss there. Turbine fans move a dynamo, or an electric rotor, to basically a big rotating set of magnets around coils of wire that helps, that doesn't help. That produces the electricity and AC current. Then that gets, that basically goes through wire, so there's energy loss in that dynamo, and there's energy loss in its transmission. Then it goes to step-up transformers to bring it to high voltage, and that may go through several steps of that. So there's energy loss across those transformers until it becomes very, very high voltage, which goes across the high voltage transmission lines from the power plants to their points of use. And a point of use could be a city. And then it goes to another power station where its voltage gets dropped again through other transformers because it doesn't need to go through the long distances anymore. Once you get it closer to its power source, you can step the voltage down to safer levels, to more appropriate levels. And then it goes across wires to its point of use, let's say a charging station. So there's energy loss there. Then there's another transformer that brings it down to 120 volts, which there's power loss there. Then you hook it up to your car. That charges batteries inside your car. Elon Musk's lithium-ion batteries. There's energy loss there. Then that energy is sent by DC to the DC motors inside the car. There's energy loss there. Then to its transmission. So from bringing the coal out of the ground to the motors, to the transmission of the Tesla car, there's a lot of loss when you add it up. And so when you think about it in those terms, there's actually probably more emissions being dumped into the atmosphere by using an electric car than there is with a gasoline-powered engine. So if we look at the actual emissions that are happening, all the heat loss, all the emissions loss, it takes coal, you're consuming coal through all that loss, and it is being emitted to the atmosphere, and it is not zero by any means. As a matter of fact, I would contend that there's more heat produced, more carbon produced using an electric car than there is with an oil-based gasoline engine, gasoline or diesel engine. The same losses would hold true, though a little bit less, with an oil-fired power facility versus a coal-fired power facility. You would still be losing more energy through all the losses along the way than you would, I believe, with a gasoline engine. If you can remember, I'm sure people remember the famous National Geographic photograph of the big giant pile of coal with a light bulb sitting on top of it. And this was meant to illustrate the amount of coal that is used per year to support that light bulb through its year of use. In other words, if you turn that light bulb and leave it for a certain amount of time, I don't know if it was on constantly for a year or not, but that much coal would be burned to keep that energy. And it was a pretty big pile. It was taller than a person and certainly wider than a car. It was a lot of coal. So somebody did that calculation to illustrate that, and if that's the case, then can you imagine how much coal it takes per year to support an electric car? Nobody illustrates that these days, I guess, because it's not, people kind of politically just skip over it because it's not part of their agenda, or they just haven't thought about it. So I really think people should be very careful when they want to shop for an electric car in spirit of the environment. They really need to sit down and think about, first of all, which power grid they live in. And if it is a petroleum-based power grid, how much energy they may actually be losing and how much emissions are being produced to support that car. Now if they're honest with themselves and go through that analysis, they may find out they have a decision to make. If they find that the electric car is producing more emissions than they thought, they may think, well, maybe I should go to a gasoline engine, just a very efficient one. And I really think if you put the two cars side by side, I would not be surprised if the gasoline power engine emits less emissions and actually is more efficient. And if you think about it to its source, the petroleum that comes out of the ground is fluid-based, so you're pumping to get it out. It's not the same as taking heavy earth-moving machinery and drilling and grinding and picking up with loaders and grinding it down to something that has more surface area to burn. It's easier to work with from end to end, even, you know, from its point of extraction from the ground through refinery, through delivery to local reserve stations, to your gas station actually, and then to your tank. It's just lots of fluids moving through pipes. It's very easy. As a matter of fact, the hardest effort in dealing with the petroleum business is moving it across the ocean. It takes a lot of energy to move an oil freighter across a body of water, versus if they extract that oil from one's own land and run it through pipes. Homegrown homegrown petroleum is far more efficient to move around the country. So once you get it to your car, I would gather to suggest that all the energy from source to your car is less than coal to your car, adding the losses. And then when it's actually in your car, you're actually consuming that material and converting it into energy at its point of use, directly at its point of use, not in some factory that's hundreds of miles away, but right there, ready to go. So you have all your specific emissions control systems there to manage it and to sort of purify it and to use it. So I would gather to suggest that somebody who's trying to buy a car in spirit of protecting the environment ought to consider not buying an electric car and buying a petroleum-based car. So if they really want to do that, I would consider hybrid. I think hybrid is the way to go. You know, to maximizing the efficiency of the energy storage you have in your point-of-use car. Of course, there's lots of losses when you're using petroleum-based car and a hybrid system. In other words, a battery, an onboard battery and generation system is on board there ready to compensate for those losses and save them up for use later. That's a wonderful way to go. So I really think hybrid should be the future, and these electric cars, I think the world is stepping into an area they don't understand what they're stepping into, and it's going to create far more of a mess than we believe it is. And you know, every time I see this zero emission sticker on an electric vehicle, I want to call it a lie, because it's nothing more than a political statement, and it's a lie at best. So I just want to get your thoughts on that. Anyway, enjoy the show. Take it easy. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Mark. So, Elon Musk, if you watched his presentation, he mentioned the grid, and he was talking about, now this was the battery wall presentation. He was mentioning the grid, and he mentioned his electric cars, and he did mention the fact that the emissions. He was talking about the emissions from coal-fired plants, etc. So he did mention it. I think a lot of people. There's a lot of people that don't have a clue where their electricity comes from. They just think that it's just electricity. Why don't we just run everything on electricity and then everything? Why do we have this dirty coal and this awful oil? Let's just run everything on electricity and it could be utopia. And I don't guess they realize where the electricity comes from. It either comes from nuclear. Or it comes from, and I'm talking about the grid itself. It either comes from nuclear, as you mentioned, or it comes from coal, or maybe some of it comes from hydroelectric. But there's very tiny percentage of it now is coming from solar. Now, what Elon Musk, his vision, if you watched his presentation, his vision is. That, and I believe it would work. It could work. You produce enough solar. You have to have enough solar panels and enough storage. Excuse me. You have to have enough storage. And maybe you'll never completely eliminate the grid as we know it, as far as. You're still going to probably have, to a certain extent, you're going to have some kind of conventional generation, electric generation. but the capacity of that could be reduced. The problem with, and he goes into it in this presentation, the problem with the grid is in the conventional, conventional generation as we know it, is that they have to be able to deal with peak usage. And peak usage in the middle of the day in the summer, let's say it's in the middle of the day in the summer in Houston, Texas, peak usage is, you're going to be hitting peak usage because you've got jillions of air conditioners running. And the same applies for most areas of the country. A place like Houston is going to be more of an extreme example than, let's say, you know, Minneapolis, Minnesota. But even in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in the middle of the summer, you're going to have peak usage because you're going to have people running air conditioners because it does get hot and humid there. Maybe not quite as hot and humid as it does in Houston, Texas, but you do need air conditioning. So the peak usage is the problem because it peaks. So they have to have the capacity to satisfy the peak demand without having brownouts. And then during the lulls, the low usage points, this is a problem that people often don't think about, but they're generating too much electricity at the low usage points, but because of the economics, they really can't shut the system down, because to shut the system down completely or reduce it would be a problem. So then they have to figure out, well, where are we going to shunt this energy to? So Elon Musk was saying, and I do believe the idea would work, is that you have enough of the, like this battery wall idea. You have enough batteries that you could store the excess energy during low peak times, let's say in the middle of the night, especially if you're generating with coal, and then you shunt that energy into these batteries, and then you are able to utilize that energy once the peak usage comes along. Now, if you're completely solar, then you're going to have, you're not going to be generating anything at night, obviously. So the way that this could work, where we could be 100% solar, there's only one way that it would really work, and that means that you're going to have to just over-design everything. So you're going to have to, you would attack the problem with massive numbers of batteries and massive numbers of solar panels. Attack the problem that way. If you have enough, basically you'd have to over design, over capacity, and then you would have enough to make it reliable. And that's essentially what they've had to do with conventional grid and conventional power generation. They've had to over design and over capacity in order to make the thing as reliable, the reliable system that we've all grown up with and we're all familiar with. It just works. You turn the light switch on and the light comes on. You turn it off and it goes off. But the power is always there unless there's some kind of a problem. Usually some sort of a natural disaster, a storm, or something like that. But otherwise the thing is really super reliable. But it's because they have over-designed it, and so you could do the same thing. If let's say that I wanted to be 100% independent from the grid, but I would still use the same amount of electricity that I use during the year. So obviously when I'm home in the middle of the summer, I'm using the most electricity, And then let's say I'm home for about 5 or 6 days, and then I leave, and then obviously my air conditioning doesn't run nearly as much. It's going to run a little bit because I've got when I leave in the middle of the summer, I leave the thing set on 90 degrees, so it is going to come and it is going to run some if it gets really hot during the hot part of the summer. And in the winter, obviously then I'm using propane, but I still use some electricity for the furnace is still using some electricity for the fan, for the blower, for heat exchange purposes. So the distributing the ventilation, distributing the warmed air. So, but just my needs. Let's imagine that I want to be 100% independent from the grid. So I would have to, I don't know how many batteries I'd have to have, and I'd have to be able to, I'd have to have a pretty good storage. I'd have to, obviously I would have to have as much so that I would be able to run the thing for as much as I needed, run the air conditioning as much as I possibly needed. I would have to have a massive number of batteries and a massive number of solar panels to charge those batteries. Just my house alone, and using it in the limited way that I do, because most people are home all the time. I'm gone a good deal of the time, so I don't use as much energy as the average person does. Just that alone, for me to be able to use all the energy that I needed, I'd have to really have overcapacity in the system. Serious overcapacity. And then I would have to have I'd have to be able to have a 220 inverter, and there's ways of wiring so that you can get 220, but I'd have to, the 5110 inverter that I have right now, I would have to have probably at least two of those, and 5000 watts would probably not be enough. They'd probably have to be bigger. So in order to and then there's times when I run the air conditioner, and heaven forbid I'm also drying clothes in a clothes dryer, so that the meter spins pretty fast. Then you got two different things that are sucking lots of power, and then maybe the refrigerator kicks in. So just imagine all of the capacity, the overcapacity that I would have to have just to be able to charge those batteries, and with all of the energy that I would need, because if let's say I was completely disconnected from the grid, plus look at how many batteries I'd have to charge, keep charged, and then in order to be able to demand that during my peak usage. So it could be done. It could be done, and it could be done on a mass scale. But you'd have to have you'd have to attack the problem with absolute mass numbers of batteries. Now, we've really done the same thing with oil-based technology, coal-based technology. You've got massive coal mines. There's massive oil drilling that takes place there. A lot of it's hidden from us, or we just don't see it, but there's massive resources that go into keeping the energy systems that we have right now, keeping those working, keeping everything running. It's a massive system that we already have. But that's already in place, so it could be done. But all these things could be done, but it would require mass over design, a massive over design of the system, so that you could store all of this energy. You'd be able to store the energy, and then people would be able to retrieve it when they needed it. And now, as far as the Tesla, like this Model S, looks like an interesting vehicle. They're claiming, what'd they say, it would go 298 miles on a single charge. Now, I don't know, is that with the air conditioner running? What happens if you're running the air conditioning? That's going to make the thing go down faster, I would think. So I don't know how they rate that. It looks like if I watched this video that I was talking about earlier that was on YouTube, but it was originally broadcast on National Geographic Channel. That is a sweet car. There's no question about it. That is one sweet car. It's very expensive. The Model S is $127,000 car. Amazing technology. The factory itself used to be the one in Fremont, that it was a GM factory originally. That is it's amazing what they've done with that factory. It's incredible. And the robots that they're using, it's amazing. And the design of the car, all of the engineering that's gone into it, absolutely amazing. But probably would be fine if you live in a city and you're not driving around that much and you can take it home and plug it back in. But as far as the zero emissions goes, obviously most people don't want to make a mess. Unless, you know, some messes you need to make. As a human being, you're going to make messes. And human beings going about their business, we make messes. And so you try to clean up the messes, or you try to figure out ways of avoiding messes in the first place. So in an ideal world, if you could put all of the resources into the batteries and into the solar panels and really all the resources that you would really need in order to make something like that work, if you really did that, then you could get, theoretically, if you did it enough and you were determined, you could get to the point where you would have little or no need for conventional oil or coal. But at the same time, the idea that you're going to have zero emissions, and then these stickers that you were talking about, it's those people are not that make those stickers. They're probably idiots, or they're designed. And even if the people that are putting the stickers on there, they're designed. That's just a marketing message for the idiots that want to believe in zero emissions. It's almost like a religious thing. Helping to save the earth, and you should feel so good about San Francisco because they've got their little zero emission stickers on their vehicles or on the electric streetcars or whatever. Never mind where the electricity comes from. So it's just it's mindless gobbledygook. Typical typical mindless stuff, and it's designed to so that that appeals to a certain type of person that it's going to that they're going to get a really good feeling. They feel like they're, oh, this is so nice. San Francisco is such a wonderful place. And it's designed to kind of give the person that appeals to a little boost, a little endorphin rush, because it sort of affirms their religion. It affirms their, they want to believe in San Francisco and the whole quote-unquote green mindset, then it kind of gives, it's sort of designed to give a little boost to their idolatry. So, but the electric car, it's interesting. And Elon Musk is an interesting guy. And it's going to be interesting when they come out with this Model 3, because that's the one that's supposed to be affordable, where every normal people can buy that if they want it. And it's going to be interesting to see what kind of range it has, how practical it is. Would I buy one? No. But I'm not right now. I don't really have any plans personally on buying any new vehicle, maybe ever again. I have a 1998 F-150 pickup at home. Now, it's obviously not going to last forever. But on the other hand, it's I could easily put another 100,000 miles on it. It's got about a 120, I think it's at 124. It's either 124 or 127, 124,000 or 127,000 something, somewhere in that area. And it could easily go to 200 or 224,000. So another 100,000 I could easily put on there. And I really don't have any plans of, unless I have to replace it for some reason. Let's say it's somehow it gets destroyed or whatever, then I'd have to replace it. But otherwise, not planning on it. So we'll see. But at this point, I would not buy an electric vehicle. I wouldn't even buy a hybrid, because the hybrids, you're going to have to replace those batteries. After a certain period of time, you got to replace the batteries. That those only last maybe 10 years or whatever at most, and then the batteries have to be replaced. Well, at that point, you might as well throw the car away and get another one, because it's not going to be, probably not going to be worth it. So, unless, you know, kind of depending on how. Now, these Teslas, I don't know if they're designed, because this Tesla Model S, the batteries are actually a flat, I don't know how thick it was, it's not very super thick, maybe 4 inches, but it's a flat portion that bolts to the bottom of the car's chassis, and it gives the whole frame more rigidity. And so I don't know if that would be replaced as a single unit at some point. And that's obviously an expensive enough car, that Model S at $127,000. That's expensive enough that someone would probably want to keep the thing going and replace those batteries. Because the car is amazingly well put together and engineered. It's just a gorgeous, 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 highly desirable vehicle. And I would imagine that they're because of that, they retain their resale value. So I would imagine that people will keep these things and replace those batteries when they need to. But in your typical Toyota Prius, after 10 years, you just probably send the thing off to the trash compactor and get another one. And you know, but as far as trying to replace those batteries and the hybrid are not cheap. So I would stay away from that. What I would do if I was going to buy a new vehicle, I would get something with an efficient conventional internal combustion engine, and that's fine. Of course, I mean, personally, I have to have four-wheel drive because of where I live. Don't need it all the time, but when I need it, by golly, I really need it. And this last winter, there was that one, I think I described that. That's been a few months ago. I really needed it. And that's been, maybe a couple of months ago. So, anyway, I think I'm going to bring this to a close. So, thank you, Mark, and thank you, Joel. So, get the truck worked on hopefully tomorrow afternoon into the evening. They'll be able to get it into the shop and then get it back out, and then I can see tomorrow. Today was Monday, so tomorrow would be Tuesday. So maybe by Wednesday I'll be back headed somewhere else. So anyhow, hope everyone is having a great week so far, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.